From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour is going to be made on Saturday at 6 p.m. at Jiva Theater Center's Fielding Next Stage in a show that is almost free, almost offensively low price for the tickets, but that's part of what you're going to experience if you go out to the First Niagara Rochester Fringe Festival. The Fringe Festival starts on Thursday, runs for 10 days, and there are a number of shows, but this is a one-time-only show that focuses on the evolution of the female journalist. The show's called Intrepid, and in some ways, it makes us think about how things have changed or not changed in more than 100 years of female journalism, and Leah Stacey is the mind behind Intrepid. Now, we know Leah from 585 Magazine, but now Intrepid is a show that got into your brain when? When was the start of this, Leah?
Well, I think it was about 2 years ago, maybe almost three. I was at Syracuse University, and I had a job with the arts department doing PR and marketing for them while I was in grad school. And we were working with a wonderful company called Ping Chong, which is a documentary theater company in New York City. And they base a lot of their shows on interviews, and it's very... It appealed to the journalist side of my brain and also the theater side of my brain. And so I started thinking, if I ever wanted to experiment with a show like this, what's a really great issue that deserves some spotlight? And so the idea popped into my head a little while after that because I was studying journalism and reading about Nellie Bly and thinking, what a great story this is. Why didn't I hear more about this before I got to grad school? And so from there, I sort of outlined what I would do, but I was in grad school, so I didn't have a whole lot of time to sit down and type out a play. And so I started working on that after I graduated and worked on it mostly during summers, so the past two summers. And then the deadline for Fringe applications came up, and I was like, you know, maybe it's time to see what people think of this. And I knew that a Fringe festival was a great place to workshop a new show.
And your show is... unconventional in many ways. It's only 40 minutes long?
Yeah, so...
Or less?
Yeah, the original version is a little bit longer. We did trim it down for the festival because part of the festival is that if you present shorter shows, then people have more time to see, you know, there's more than 300 shows in the festival. So just the fact that we are even part of it, we were happy to... Well, I was happy to trim it down.
So you can see Intrepid on Saturday at 6 p.m. at Jiva Theater Center's Fielding Next Stage. You can get tickets now for only $6 on at rochesterfringe.com. Also with us in studio is Shonda Urey. And Shonda is, among many things, she's acting in the show, but she's an acting professor at Finger Lakes and Roberts Wesleyan. And in Intrepid, who are you?
I play Mary Garber, who was sort of a pioneer in the sports writing field for women.
So we're going to get to your character in just a second. I want to kind of backtrack in time because the cast is five or six. How many people?
It's five.
It's five. Okay. And it's an awesome cast. Shonda's in the cast. Our own Carlette Claire from WXXI is there. Andrea Levandusky, who was on this program recently. Andrea Holland, who we know. Sammy Cohen, who's been on the show. Shonda is actually the only person in the cast who has never been in the studio before, at least not to my knowledge. Is this first time?
This is my first time.
Well, welcome here.
Thank you.
It is a great cast. And Shonda, how's it going?
It's going really well. Yeah, we're all working really well together. None of us have worked together before, but everybody's great and really getting into their characters.
Okay, and so let's go back a little bit because you mentioned Nellie Bly, and you mentioned why as a student you grew up never really knowing that story.
Yeah.
For our listeners who don't know the story, tell us about Nellie Bly.
So Nellie Bly was the original intrepid female reporter. She was in her 20s in the late 1880s and came from a rough background in the Pittsburgh area. And so Nellie Bly is actually her pen name. She was born Elizabeth Jane Cochran. And you may have heard of her from the article that she wrote called 10 Days in a Madhouse, where she went to an insane asylum for 10 days. She feigned insanity as a sort of stunt to get her a permanent position with a newspaper in Pittsburgh. And so, or in New York City, I'm sorry. And so she's very famous from that 10 Days in a Madhouse. But what people don't always know about her is that she was one of the original female reporters who did that sort of work, that investigative, experiential, what we call immersion journalism, putting herself in the situation and reporting back firsthand. And there's a little bit of acting involved. She liked drama. And so for her to feign insanity, you know, that obviously makes for great theater. So she was a natural place to start the show. And also one of my personal inspirations. I just love the work that she did.
But let me also ask, out of my own ignorance, I mean, I knew of the Nellie Bly story, but not in the detail that you're going to tell it, and not certainly not in the detail that you've had to research for it. So what I don't know is, how much did she fight at the time? It was 1880 is where the show starts there with her?
Yeah.
We've talked about on this show with Ruth Scott and other Rochester pioneers that even in the 1950s and 60s, women were basically told if you wanted to work, you had to be a teacher, probably a childhood education teacher. I mean, journalism, what kind of field was it for women?
It was still a very new field. You had to be a teacher or a nurse as a woman.
Yeah.
And so Nellie Bly in the 1880s, for her to be doing this work was just incredible. And the same for, I believe, the show goes from 1880 to 1950. We end with Martha Gellhorn, who was one of Hemingway's wives, but also a great journalist and travel writer in her own right. And what it's really showing is I picked these five characters who were trailblazers in not only journalism, because it was still crazy to be a female journalist, but they were also trailblazers in their specific fields, like Mary with sports. And so Nellie Bly was the best place to start it just because she was the first one to get notice worldwide. She went around the world in, I believe it was 79 days. I could be off by a few days on that. But she read Jules Verne's book, Around the World in 80 Days, and she said, I can do this, and I can beat it, and I can be nonfiction while I'm doing it. She came back with a pet monkey. She actually, another journalist was racing her at the same time, and she still beat her, and then she wrote a book about it. And that book is wonderful. So she kind of went into the world of travel writing with that. She was wonderful at painting scenes of countries that people weren't even traveling to yet, and she went as a single woman with one outfit.
So there's a taste of where the show starts, Intrepid, the show with Nellie Bly. And that your point, Leah, there is so well taken, not just with Nellie Bly. You go down this list, and I wonder how many characters, if any, our listeners really know much about. So Nellie Bly, Ida B. Wells.
Yeah.
Ida B. Wells.
So Ida B. Wells was a black female journalist, and she was friends with people at the time who were starting businesses, and they were black business owners. And she came back from traveling. She was a very well-known speaker and writer at the time, and came back from traveling to find that several of her friends had actually been lynched. And so she launched an investigative pamphlet. She published an actual pamphlet about lynchings and about the horrors that her people were facing. Just, you know, lynchings, there were mobs, there were businesses being burned. And so much of the white society, which she was part of with her writing and speaking, was turning, you know, a deaf ear and a blind eye to that. So she was one of the first civil rights journalists. And then, of course, being a female. And she was also a mother of four children, which is not something that you find so much in journalistic history, especially with women. You know, you kind of launch into your career and that takes over. But part of her spiel was that she really wanted to make the world a better place for her children, and that motivated her work.
And that that scene is set in the show in 1890.
Yes.
Okay. Next one is 1910, Ida Tarbell.
Ida Tarbell, she's been covered up in history a little bit because she went against Rockefeller. She went up against the oil industry. Her father was in the oil industry very early, and so she grew up in those circles and knowing what was and wasn't ethical. And she decided that she was going to publish that. Her writing appeared in McClure's magazine, which back then was one of the first magazines publishing investigative pieces. And so she went right against the business tycoons. And again, her social circles completely turned their backs to her for that work.
That's 1910.
Mm-hmm.
Shonda Urey plays Mary Garber.
Yep. Start
in circa 1940 in the show. What did you know about Mary Garber before you got into the show?
Absolutely nothing.
Really?
Yeah, I'd never heard of her.
Which, Leah, that's probably very cool for you to hear that.
Yeah, I actually love that.
So, all right, so Shonda, tell us about Mary Garber.
Well, Mary Garber really was such a pioneer in sports writing for women. I mean, women, one of the great quotes that I love from the play is, you know, women weren't allowed on the sidelines unless you were a lover or a mother. You know, like, they were children and women were banned from the press box in any sort of game. And she went in and she would run up and down the sidelines. You know, she would keep her own statistics. She would do it all while running back and forth on the sidelines during any game. And she was also really instrumental in covering not only white but black players and black schools and colleges in the South. She was working in North Carolina at the time.
Why did you choose? I should also say to Leah, you chose five. I mean, what was the cut like? Yeah, I mean.
Well, originally it was 10.
10.
Yeah. Okay. So I picked the five as I was going through that seemed to be the most visual and also would represent the widest span of time because we do only have that 35 minutes. But it also was a little bit based on the cast because I solicited several people we wanted to have. Well, I wanted to have, and there had been talks with Jeeva about how cool would it be if we had, you know, writers playing the characters, people who could feed into this with their own life experience. And so that was certainly the goal. Of course, we know journalists are extremely, incredibly busy. And I did want people who had acting experience. So part of the characters that I picked from that 10 when I was trimming down the show was people who could be played really well by the cast that I had.
And Shonda, by the way, when you talk about Mary Garber saying that only lovers and mothers were allowed on the sidelines when it comes to sports in the 1940s, you wonder just how out of place that sentiment is 75 years later, which is sort of sad, but you know.
It really is.
I'm not saying that women aren't in journalism. There are some of the very, very best sports journalists today are women. But every now and then, you still get chauvinism sort of
absolutely
coming through.
Yeah, I was just reading a whole article about how Pam Oliver is getting sort of shoved off the sidelines, for someone younger and blonder. And, you know, and yes, she's being replaced by a woman. But, you know, how much of that is ageism? If she were a man, would she really be getting moved off the sidelines in the same way?
And the amazing thing about Pam is I think she's, I don't know. I thought she was like 38, and it's like, oh, that's ancient for, and which is obviously not ancient. But you're right in that. I always try to be careful when I say that. I know plenty of great journalists who are white and blonde, but when so many are, it's easy for a Pam Oliver to feel like this is just, you know, look what has happened to the industry, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think her feeling, at least from the article I was reading, was really it had more to do with her age than anything else, that they felt she was getting too old.
Leah, I asked Shonda about Mary Garber, and you briefly touched on it, but why did you want to make sure she was one of the five?
I love Mary Garber's history. I love that she was at a smaller paper in North Carolina. I love that she was a pioneer not only in sports writing, but, you know, like she said, she was running up and down the sidelines in a skirt and Oxfords. You know, imagine how hard that would be. She was also a really colorful person. I read a lot of interviews with her that I could get my hands on. And she shone through in those interviews. You know, she had a real love for what she was doing. And she would always take the humble card when they asked her, you know, but did you go to the high schools because you love the kids? And she would say, well, I don't know that I necessarily connected with them. But then they would interview the kids, and they would be like, we love Mary, you know. Miss Garber, she's the best. She's the one we want covering our games. So I was really drawn to her personality, and I am not an athlete. So for me to pick, you know, someone who's covering sports writing, that's the one thing I've really never covered.
And are you a sports fan?
I don't know if I should answer this on the air. I don't watch sports other than socially, if that's
If other people happen to me and you have to endure
it. Yeah.
No, but that I think that you get outside your comfort zone a little bit. You at least appreciate someone like Mary Garber. And then you you wrap up Intrepid with Martha Gellhorn.
Yeah. So I studied Hemingway pretty heavily when I was younger, and I had heard Martha Gellhorn's name, but I didn't really know too much about her other than she was one of his many wives. And so researching her more for this show, because when I really wanted someone who had done travel and war journalism, and she fits that to a T. And then she was also a novelist. So she was this incredibly ambitious woman and had quite a lot to say for herself. One thing in particular being that she didn't want Hemingway's name attached to her. She wanted to be Martha Gellhorn. She was Martha Gellhorn.
Is that partially why so few of us know her name anymore?
I think
which is sad in many ways. But.
Yeah, I think it definitely has a lot to do with it. Because if you look down her list of works and the places she was published and the wars she covered, it's extensive. And it deserves a lot more credit than just being Hemingway's third wife.
Yeah. Leah Stacey is the creator of Intrepid, and you have one chance to see it Saturday at 6 p.m. at Jiva Theater Center's Fielding Next Stage. And you can get tickets at rochesterfringe.com. It's one of the many productions as part of the 2014 First Niagara Rochester Fringe Festival that starts on Thursday and runs for 10 days. So Leah's the creator of Intrepid. Shonda Urey is one of the five is the term actor? Is that... I almost said actresses, and I actually slapped my hand.
I'm actually not offended by either of those terms.
Are some people offended by it? I actually don't know.
I don't know. I've never heard anybody say that.
It's not demeaning. I'm only asking for protocol sake. I actually don't know the answer. What would you have said, Leah? Would you have said actresses or actors?
I would have said actresses.
Okay. All right.
But I know that there are some schools of thought where actor is the more PC term.
Okay. Well, Sean is one of five, and in some ways, I want to ask a lot of details now about the show, but in other ways, I don't want to give it away. It's only 35 minutes,
right?
But there are so many different things you could have chosen to do in pulling Nellie Bly, Ida B. Wells, Ida Tarbell, Mary Garber, Martha Gellhorn. I don't know how much we see them together. You mentioned it's sort of documentary style. Is that kind of a good way to describe it?
But it's also a very heavy ensemble show. So they are all on stage for the entire show.
All five. Okay.
Yeah.
And how much imagination did you feel you wanted to use? And how much did you feel you still had to make sure the characters were true to their historical characters?
Well, when I was writing, I used a lot of tons of research. I did so much research for the show because you're talking about people who were alive at one time and you don't want to screw up the facts, especially as a journalist writing a show. But I did pull from their original writing. There's a piece in each person's sort of their own stage time, which is directly from the person's writing. And we have been working in rehearsals to make it really clear which parts are directly from the person's writing. And so when I went to write around that original work, I had to be very cognizant of writing in a way that people talked when they were alive.
Yeah.
So, again, tons of research and a lot of great feedback from the cast. You know, they were some of the first few people to really read the whole show in its trimmed down version, and they have had awesome input. They're so valuable.
Well, I love that you drew on history for your writing, because here's an example of a recent writer who gets a lot of credit, but I think it's overdone. So Aaron Sorkin gets a lot of credit as a great writer, but if you actually read the script and you took out the names of the character, they all talk the same. They all speak in aphorism and they speak in this remarkable dialogue and language, and every sentence is structured the same, no matter if it was on the West Wing or whatever it was. So anyway, that's my one little aside on writing, and I appreciate that. Shonda, for you, you teach acting.
I do.
So when you're playing a historical figure, how much do you drill into that person, and how much do you think that will help your performance?
Well, I mean, it's going to be a little bit hard because physically Mary Garber was about 90 pounds and 5 foot tall, which is very not me in a lot of ways. And there's not a lot of, like, film of her moving around, so you can't really capture a lot of her mannerisms. But we are trying to sort of capture her. Leah pointed out that she was very famous for wearing this little knit cap all the time, and so I'm trying to sort of capture that, get a costume piece. She wore glasses. I have some glasses that look like her. So I'm trying to, you know, sort of capture her in her energy and little pieces to sort of bring her to life.
I didn't even give out a phone number, but we have a call, which I was so immersed with you two. So anyway, this is Jack in Clifton Springs. Jack, thanks for calling. I appreciate you joining Connections.
Yeah, I'm interested in the panel's reaction, if they have one, in regard to a blogger or sports writer who got on the internet and was lambasting female sports writers. I believe he was on the West Coast. Since you've been talking about that, I'm curious to know if they have a reaction to it, if they know anything about it. It's very recent.
You mean just in general?
I don't know.
Just ripping female sports writers in general?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he really took him to task. He said something about, well, you invading my turf, and you don't belong there, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, well, so, yeah, Jack, thanks for the call. And I'm not familiar. I don't know if either of you are familiar, but let me at least ask, even if you're not familiar with the specific episode that Jack's talking about, this is the conversation that happens when people say, whose turf is it? You know, I mean, you're smiling over there, Shonda, because like I said, I mean, this is not 1940,
exactly.
It's 2014.
Yeah. Exactly, and yet, you know, that's exactly the sort of things that Mary Garber would encounter in the 1940s. You know, she was out there doing a man's job, and she only really got the job being a full-time sports writer because her editor finally came around after years. He finally realized she knew more about sports than most of his sports writers, male sports writers.
Well, I think the fact that this is still happening is kind of beautiful because that's the whole point of the show. And so I don't agree with the fact that it's happening, but it certainly says, like, hey, there is an issue here. And people should be paying attention. And, you know, I've been mentioning to other people that we love for younger girls and college students who are female and aspiring journalists to come see this show and to know, like, this is the world you're walking into. You know, we hear a lot about women can do the same jobs as men, but there is still a startling statistic in the newsroom. Only 30% of the newsroom is female. And that's something that we need to sit up and take a look at.
Have you had any of your own experiences that you probably will keep them very internal? But, I mean, did that partially inspire any of this work that you're doing here, Leah?
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah?
Absolutely. I don't think that I've experienced it to the extent that some other women that I know have, but my friends and colleagues' experiences certainly filter into this as well.
Why? I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, I work in newsrooms. I've worked in newsrooms since I left college, but 30% is remarkably low.
Yeah, and I believe that's focused more on a newspaper and online newsroom.
Shonda, you've seen the show now, at least most of it.
Yes.
Whatever. I mean, there may be some tweaks coming, but you've seen the show now.
Yes.
How much enjoyment did you get out of not only digging into Mary Garber, but also learning about Nellie Bly and Ida Wells and Ida Tarbell and Martha Gellhorn?
I loved it. I didn't know. You know, some of those names sort of popped for me that I had heard before, but I'm definitely a history buff, especially women's history. So getting to know more details about these women who really blaze trails and open doors for women was really exciting.
Yeah, and Leah, let me ask you sort of that larger philosophical question about what we choose to educate people about in the historical mm-hmm. figures, because in many ways, you could look at these characters in your show and say, it's a shame that we're not learning about them or learning more about them. Now, mm-hmm. There's always going to be figures in history who made a mark that don't get into every history book. But do you think there is a larger trend that minimizes some of the intrepid women throughout history? Is it easier for the man to get in the history book?
Yeah, I think that because our profession has been so dominated by men, and I don't mean that they've been dominators, but they've just been naturally handed that role. And I think because of that, you know, I would love to see in a journalism program at a school somewhere a whole class about female journalists. Why not? It's a gender issue, right? So I'd love to see something like that. And part of this show is, you know, we're blending, you're going to see some modern touches in the show because the whole underlying theme is that these are still issues. Maybe we're not having people lynched. Maybe we're not actually being jailed, or maybe we're not feigning insanity. But these are still issues, even if they're in smaller ways, like salary inequalities. You know, we're still facing these issues in newsrooms.
Well, and I have said on this program when we've talked about race, for example, if you go back to the 1960s or earlier, what you have are low-hanging fruit, obvious forms of disgusting racism, separated bathrooms, separated restaurants, obviously ridiculous schooling, bus, everything, you know, things that you could easily point to and say, all right, that's ridiculous. What you have now is sort of this pernicious, slightly more subtle, enough so that it's easy to say, we've moved past it. Probably the same way when it comes to women in journalism, that you say, oh, it's fine now. Women can work anywhere. Women can work in a locker room. Women can work in sports. Women can cover wars. Women do cover wars. So
absolutely.
So what's the problem? You know, and I actually think that makes it more difficult, but maybe even just as important or more, to dig into it. So let me wrap up with this, Leah. When people leave the show, they're going to learn about these characters, but what do you want them to take with it?
Well, we want them to take and we want them to give, because we are actually going to ask people to give us feedback on the show via Twitter. So that'll be something that we're looking for from the audience. But we want them to take the concept of the show. We want them to take this issue and be more cognizant of it. We want them to know these names. If someone brings up Ida Tarbell in a conversation, to not glaze over that, but to say, hey, I actually know about some of the work she did and why she's important and why that name is still being spoken.
Shonda, as an actor, what do you want them to take?
I'd love them to walk out of the theater going, well, I didn't really know anything about those people, but now I really want to go, you know, read a book or an article or do a Google search about these people and try and find out more and what their impact was on journalism and the women's movement in general.
I love that. And to just restate, I think what Leah was saying about the way history is written. I didn't take it to mean that you're saying it's malicious. It's more when you've got 70% of men in the newsroom,
mm-hmm.
and that's probably an all-time low now. You know, 30% of journalists are women, and that's probably an all-time high. So when it's always been 70% or more of men writing the stories, mm-hmm. it's probably subconsciously natural that men are going to be featured more in the history books. And that's not malicious. It's probably human nature, but that's why I think shows like this have such great value beyond the entertainment value, and the cast is great. It's really, I mean, Shonda, I don't know you. I assume you're great. I know the rest.
Well, I am, but everyone else is really, really good.
It really is, isn't it, Shonda?
Yeah.
You're an acting teacher, and so I don't know how the rest actually do as actors, but I can say I know them personally. I know them professionally. Leah, you've put together a really great cast.
I'm happy with it.
Well, Shonda, thanks for taking the time. Nice to
Thank
see you.
You.
Nice to meet you in here. Leah, good luck with the show, Intrepid, 6 p.m. Saturday night at Jiva Theater Center's Fielding Next Stage. Tickets are $6. The show is 35 minutes long, and you can get them at Rochester Fringe, and then you can get on with your night. You can go to dinner. You can go out. You can go to many other of the Rochester Fringe Festival shows. That's part of the point. Have fun, I hope.
Oh, I think
Are you
will.
Having fun?
Yeah, we're having fun already.
Thanks for educating us on some of these characters.
Thank you.
Short break, and we're coming back with another documentary maker. This time it's a filmmaker, and you're going to learn all about what made Teddy Roosevelt president, the 9 days that led up to that, next.
Opening this week at the Little, the trip to Italy brings back everyone's favorite traveling duo, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, as they are off together once again in this sequel to the 2010 hit film, The Trip. This time, they make their way through Italy, indulging in some sparkling banter, Michael Caine impersonations, and of course, discussing the merits of sequels. So if you like beautiful shots of food, Italian landscapes, and two comedic titans driving each other nuts, check out The Trip to Italy. See details at thelittle.org.
WXXI is proud to offer significant value to the organizations that support our programs and services. From nonprofit groups to local businesses, organizations large and small turn to WXXI Public Broadcasting to connect with desirable audiences, demonstrate corporate social responsibility, and generate community goodwill. To learn more about underwriting and sponsorship opportunities on WXXI radio and television, please email underwriting@wxxi.org.
Welcome back to Connections on WXXI, talking a lot about what's happening Saturday at 6 p.m. We were just talking about the show Intrepid that runs one time only, Saturday, 6 p.m. We should also tell you there is an outstanding documentary if you happen to be in on Saturday, 6 p.m. on WXXI-TV. 9 long days, TR's Journey to the White House. Matt Ryan is the producer and host of the documentary. He's also the managing editor and the co-host of NYN Online, New York Now. Matt, it is so nice to talk to you. How are you?
Evan, great to be with you.
Well, 6 p.m. Saturday, but this really runs, your documentary on Teddy Roosevelt runs in conjunction with Ken Burns and what we've been seeing on WXXI this week. Is that right?
That's right. When we had the conversation kind of as a team here at WMHT out in Albany, as I'm sure you guys did there out in Rochester, we talked about, well, what kind of a companion program can we produce to go along with the series, because where we are out in eastern New York, we have Hyde Park in our viewing area, which, of course, is where FDR
yep.
and Eleanor were from. Of course, we have the state capitol where FDR and Teddy Roosevelt were governor, and also the Adirondacks, which was a big part of the story for those people who don't know.
Well, we're going to be getting some of those details, and we're not going to give it all away, but I will say that I've had a chance to watch it, the half-hour documentary. It is outstanding. You really did a fantastic job, Matt, and I really mean that. But before I do, only because every time this family becomes a topic of conversation on the show, I have a caller or a listener who will email me to ask, why are you pronouncing it certain ways? And everything that I've been told, and I could be wrong, was that Teddy was Roosevelt and Franklin became Roosevelt, but I don't know that that's true. What do we know about the historical name?
It's funny. From what I've found out personally, is first off, we talked to a couple admitted old-timers, gentlemen who were in their 70s, and interestingly enough, they both called him Roosevelt. And that was the common pronunciation for a lot of people, but Teddy Roosevelt himself insisted, no, it is pronounced Roosevelt. So a little bit of a controversy, but that's how Teddy Roosevelt said his name. He said, like the flower, Roosevelt.
Okay, so Teddy himself.
That's the source, so I got to go with that.
And for our listeners, Matt's phone is getting a little digitally funky. So, Matt, if it sort of won't settle down, we'll reestablish a connection. But let me...
Okay.
So let me ask you, though, where you start with this. I mean, you chose to tell the story of what put Teddy Roosevelt in the White House, and that's an important point because as much as he was, as you say in the documentary, a huge historical figure in so many different ways and parts of American culture, there was no guarantee that he was going to be in the White House at that point, right?
Yeah, that to me that
or I should say was going to be president. There was no
right.
guarantee that he was going to be president.
Correct. Yeah, that's what was most fascinating to me. I mean, here's a guy whose face is on Mount Rushmore. And by the way, the decision to put him up on Mount Rushmore only came 20 years after his presidency, which is really kind of unheard of nowadays. But yeah, that's what to me it was so fascinating. Here's a guy who's considered by just about every historian you ask a top five president. But, you know, if not for this tragedy out in Buffalo, you know, it may never have happened.
But Matt, why not? People say he was vice president. He had he'd already had a pretty remarkable resume. Why wouldn't he have been president?
Well, a couple different things. One, the reason that Republican leaders wanted him to become vice president was because he was causing such a stir out here in New York. You know, he was definitely a progressive Republican. I don't know if that was an actual term back then, but a lot of the establishment party didn't like him because of he supported a certain set number of hours for women, for children, and just for the workday in general. And that didn't sit well with a lot of people in his party. And so one of the plan was to put him on the vice presidential ticket because if that happens, you know, we'll never hear from him again. And so of course that never ended up happening. But, you know, as I talked to a lot of different people, a biographer out here named Paul Grondahl, he just said he's had a lot of skeletons in his closet. He had a lot of enemies within his own party. And so that's why a lot of people thought he may have never actually made it without this tragedy.
President McKinley was shot, what was it, two times in the stomach? Is that correct?
Twice. One was in the breastbone, which was superficial, and the other one was through his stomach and hit his kidney as well.
And when he was shot, there had to be some decisions on medically how to handle it and where. And first of all, let me ask you, if the exact same scenario happened in 2014, would he have survived?
By all accounts, absolutely he would have. The best doctor that they had in the area happened to be up at Niagara Falls at the time. His name, by the way, was Roswell Park, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. But there was a lot of concern about transporting him. For those of your listeners who are familiar with Buffalo, this happened out in the northern part of the city by around where the Buffalo History Museum is, around Delaware Avenue. And, the nearest hospital was a good mile away. And, you know, they didn't have paved streets back then, so they were really concerned about taking him over these bumpy roads in the city of Buffalo. And so they kind of had, choice number six when it came to doctor. I think it was actually a gynecologist who performed the surgery. And they never ended up finding the bullet. He got an infection. And, after a long week plus, he ended up dying because of his wounds.
Talking to Matt Ryan, the producer and host of the new documentary, Nine Long Days, TR's Journey to the White House. You can see it Saturday, 6 p.m. on WXXI-TV. I have seen it. It is outstanding. And Matt is telling us not just about the documentary, but about the process. Because when you see this documentary, you see a lot of headlines that come from the time. And your headlines show that in those early hours, in those nervous times, the tide turned for a short while, and everyone was reporting the president is going to be fine. He's going to recover.
Yeah, it was a great treat to be able to see some of the old newspapers. I went over to the public library in the city of Buffalo, and the Buffalo Courier was the paper of choice back then. And their motto, by the way, was fearless and honest, which I think is just great. But, yeah, for a couple days, we're talking around September 9th, September 10th, three, 4 days after the shooting, the paper was virtually assuring their readers that McKinley was going to be fine. In fact, the president of the Pan-American Exposition, the World Fair that was being held there at the time, said, you know what, we're going to have another President's Day just to make up for this bad one that we had here on September 6th. So, yeah, I mean, back then, I'm sure when people read that, they were like, okay, you know, things are starting to get back to normal. And Teddy Roosevelt, who had been there for a few days, you know, he decided to leave town for a couple different reasons. I think one, because he probably didn't want to seem like he was waiting for McKinley to die. But the other reason that, you know, there was definite optimism that he was going to survive. And so he went back to join his family in the Adirondacks on a already planned vacation.
What was Teddy Roosevelt's relationship like with the president, McKinley?
You know, it's a great question. There's not a lot of documentation that describes the relationship. Roosevelt was actually critical of McKinley during his first administration, especially not getting into the Spanish-American War sooner. Those who have watched the Roosevelts on PBS have realized that, you know, a lot of people called Roosevelt a warmonger. I mean, he liked war, and he didn't feel that the Americans got into it soon enough. So it was a little rocky before they became a ticket in 1900. But what they did with Teddy Roosevelt, for the most part, was just kind of put him on the campaign trail, not only in 1900 when they were trying to get elected, but afterward. He was the guy who would go to the county gun show back then, or this gathering over here and this over here. He was a great public speaker, and they really utilized him, utilized his talents for that. In fact, when he first found out that McKinley had been shot, he was speaking at kind of a conservation club meeting up in northern Vermont on Lake Champlain.
And yet, for me, watching your documentary, I couldn't help but feel like his decision, even if it was marginally understandable from a psychological standpoint, was reckless. I mean, yes, the reporting was that the president was going to survive the gunshot wounds, but you're the vice president, and as you report in the documentary, he didn't want to make it seem like he was just waiting for the president to die, and yet there was a chance that the president, I mean, don't you want to wait a little longer to make sure that everything is stabilized?
Yeah, you can certainly make that argument. And, of course, back in 1901, it's not like he could just hop on an airplane and get back to Buffalo as soon as possible. What I detail, you know, in the documentary is that he found out in the Adirondacks, and, you know, he took a trip through the Adirondack Forest Preserve, a road which is now called 28N. But back then, no lights, dark, dense forest. He went through three sets of horses, three carriages before he finally made it to the North Creek Railroad Station. So, yeah, he definitely was taking a risk, but that's what Teddy Roosevelt was, right?
Well, and his own family cautioned him against it, right? Because he had been, the day before, he'd been out hiking all day, and I guess, as one of your historians in the documentary indicated, the man was very obviously very tired and probably needed to sleep and didn't have any energy left, and then finds out about the president's death. And he left on that ride, that trip. What time did he leave?
Well, it's a little foggy, but it was somewhere around midnight.
Around midnight.
It could have been as early as 10:30 or as you know, as late as 11:50. But it was, you know, he left in the middle of the night. I mean, it was completely dark, no moonlight. And like you said, he had climbed Mount Marcy on September 13th, you know, the day he found out. And I'm sure, as someone who does a lot of hiking myself, I'm sure he was bone tired, as one of our historians said. And that's why he waited so long. I mean, he got back to his cabin at about 5 o'clock, so when there's still daylight, so he could have made it easier on himself, but chose not to.
And there was certainly a non-zero chance that he could have been injured or killed in that ride, riding through the darkness, riding in that kind of terrain, right?
Yep. And there was three different trips that he had to make, and on the third trip, he actually had to carry the lantern with his right arm, holding it out for the entire hour-plus trip. just tells you how incredibly dark it was. So, yeah, it was definitely dangerous, and he ended up reaching the train station, documents say, 4:46 in the morning.
What was the reception when he finally made, you know, that arrival and made his journey?
Well, you know, what's interesting is his last driver, his name was Mike Cronin, and this guy, Mike Cronin, already knew that McKinley was dead when he picked up Roosevelt, but he never told him. He said later that he didn't want to put any extra stress on the vice president. So I guess in people in town, when he came into the North, I don't know if you've ever been to North Creek, but it's a beautiful, small little town, you know, in the southern Adirondacks. And people were waiting alongside the road. I mean, this is a very small town. This is not like in Henrietta or Pittsburgh. I mean, there's very few people in this town, but they were all standing along the side of the road waiting for Roosevelt to come into town. You know, Roosevelt was had a flair for the dramatic, and you know, there was none of that. He found out on the platform right before he got onto the train, and you know, just took the note, put it in his coat, and hopped on the train, and eventually went out to Buffalo. Interestingly, somewhere around Ballston Spa, which is in Saratoga County here, the train actually hit another one. It was right as it was stopping, but it was quite the trip.
In quite the 9 days, the documentary called Nine Long Days, TR's Journey to the White House. The producer and host of the documentary is Matt Ryan, who also is the managing editor and co-host of New York Now. He's on the line with us, and you can see it Saturday, 6 p.m. on WXXI. Now, some of the background research, you mentioned going through old newspaper headings, et cetera. I can't even imagine how you start making cuts and paring down that kind of material. But if you're a history buff, it has to be some of the most fun kind of work you can do.
It is. I told a gentleman who did a good portion of my shooting that we had a lot of great footage that got left on the cutting room floor. When you're doing something like this, anybody who's watched a Ken Burns documentary, you know, you just marvel at it, because take the Civil War, for example. He was doing a story. He did that in the late 1980s. He was doing a story about something that happened 120 years ago. You know, there's no video. He didn't have any eyewitness accounts. He somehow put together a remarkable series with just still photos and a few shots here and there about a video of the places that, you know, like some of the battlefields, you know, with just the setting sun in the background and a cannon and silhouette here and there. I mean, it's you know, I certainly don't have that talent, but you know, those are some of the elements you have to kind of involve at times when you're doing a piece that happened, a story that happened so long ago.
And Matt, maybe it's a function of just the passage of time, but most Americans would not be able to name who assassinated President McKinley. Tell us a little bit about that person.
Not only that, a lot of Americans probably couldn't even tell you who William McKinley was, which is another reason why I kind of wanted to tell the story. You know, this is a second-term president. This wasn't James Garfield, who was in office for, you know, 5 months before he got shot down. That's one of the things we talk about, you know, that some of the notorious murderers of John F. Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln, we all know, you know, John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald, for those who believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the shooter. But then there are
careful, don't open a can of worms there. We don't have time.
Yeah, we don't have time for that. Charles Guiteau was the man who shot James Garfield in 1881. And then the other one was this guy named Leon Czolgosz, born to Polish immigrants. Apparently a very bright person, lost his job after the panic of 1893. You know, his family members said he just kind of lost his way. And he ended up shooting McKinley in Buffalo on September 6th, but apparently he had tried to do it before in Ohio at a carnival, didn't make it there. There were some news reports that he was actually in Niagara Falls the morning of September 6th when he shot McKinley at Buffalo later in the afternoon, that he actually followed him to Niagara Falls in the morning, but just didn't have the right opportunity. And what happened, how he got, you know, nowadays you ask yourself, how in the world could someone get so close to the president? But here he was. McKinley was just literally in this thing called the Temple of Music, where he was shaking hands with everybody for about 2 hours. It was kind of a meet and greet with the president. And he had a handkerchief over his gun, which I'm told was over his hand. Of course, the gun was in it. But I'm told that wasn't all that unusual, because it was incredibly humid inside, and so people didn't think a lot of it. And he got his chance, and unfortunately, he took advantage of it.
Point blank, Matt?
Yeah, point blank, right in front, face to face. It's amazing he didn't kill him outright just then and there. But you know, it was a small pistol, didn't have much kick. In fact, it didn't even knock McKinley down; just kind of stunned him.
Right, and in this case, you then chronicle what happened to McKinley, and then from there we sort of start learning about what happens with Roosevelt. But is it sad to you as a lover of history that we've had four assassinated presidents and that these are names that are still foreign to a lot of Americans now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a history buff myself. I always, I'm always the nerd who wants to learn a little bit more about Millard Fillmore or William Henry Harrison.
Absolutely.
But, those are guys who are not considered great presidents. William Henry Harrison was killed after 40 days or died after 40 days, so that you can't really compare. But, yeah, this guy was in his second term. He was immensely popular. In fact, one of the historians I talked to out in Canton, Ohio, which is where he was from, he said there was a deep sense of loss in the country comparable to, what happened in 1963 when Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas.
The documentary not only has a great sense of these huge historical moments, but also some of the really colorful little details that good documentaries do. And I loved learning that McKinley had this technique when he's shaking hands for kind of grabbing somebody's hand and sort of pulling you out of the way and pulling you to the next person, right?
I know you worked in television for a while. It's always great when you get interviews that are so compelling. And we had some really fantastic people that we talked to, professors, historians, local historians, state historians. And, one of them, the Erie County historian, was describing how McKinley would kind of shake your hands and make you feel real good while at the same time kind of moving you along the line. and the other really fascinating thing, Evan, is that I really find this hard to believe, but the gun that was actually used to kill McKinley was in storage for about 100 years, and that I guess the local DA's office just thought it would be inappropriate to put it on display. And so you have this great piece of history that was, in a box for over 100 years. It's on display now at the Buffalo History Museum in the city. But for 100 years, it was under wraps.
Yeah, really remarkable stuff. A few more minutes with Matt Ryan. He is the producer and host of the documentary Nine Long Days, TR's Journey to the White House, that you can see Saturday at 6 p.m. on WXXI. Kind of dovetails with Ken Burns and the Roosevelts that you've been having a chance to see on WXXI. And this documentary tells that story of the assassination of McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt's ride and really ride into history becoming president. But speaking of Teddy Roosevelt, Matt, as you said, he had a flair for the dramatic all throughout his life. And yet, in that moment where he takes the oath of office, if I'm remembering correctly, that we don't have visual beyond a drawing of it. And tell us why.
Well, the reason why is that those who are familiar with Buffalo, it happened on 641 Delaware Avenue, north of downtown, at the Wilcox Mansion. This very wealthy gentleman named Ansley Wilcox. Roosevelt had stayed at his home for a few days, and he ended up taking the oath of office there as well in this library. It could probably fit about 40-45 people in it. And back then the cameras were on these big tripods, and someone knocked into the camera, and the tripod tipped over, and camera made a loud sound in the hallway, and Roosevelt got all upset and kicked all the reporters and photographers out, which is unusual because he liked to get his picture taken. it's amazing how many photos there are of him, but he kicked him out, and all that exists is a drawing.
So Matt, before we let you go here, every great documentary ends up with some really great stuff that gets cut. Is there anything that you can share with us that you wish would have made the cut that we're not going to see?
Yeah, you know what, and maybe this is something WXXI or WNED or affiliate out in Buffalo could do, the Pan-American Exposition that took place back then, which was essentially the World Fair. The more I read about it and the more video I see of it, Thomas Edison, his company, took some pretty compelling video. It must have been just a wonder for the eyes. We have a historian talking about how people would sit at nighttime and weep because they were seeing electricity for the first time in this glorious presentation that they had along all of these buildings. So that's really something that happened 113 years ago. That just seemed like that would make a great film. And, we did get into that a little bit, but not nearly as much as I would have liked.
But you really did have remarkable resources, the historians. Their level of knowledge and the way you tapped into that. I mean, we know that they're there, but this kind of documentary makes you appreciate those people.
Yeah, and the one thing, I mean, Buffalo has done a very good job of preserving, you know, this sad link to history that happened in their backyard. One disappointing thing, though, was that the house where actually William McKinley died was torn down about 40 or 50 years ago. Canisius High School, they wanted to expand the property, and they ended up knocking the house down. You know, only four presidents have been killed, and it's anyone who's been down to see where Lincoln died in Washington. It's compelling stuff, but yeah, they knocked it down, and it's no more.
Matt Ryan, you've got a link to our area too, don't you? You're not far from Rochester.
No, I'm a proud. I grew up in the village of Victor, graduated from Victor High School, and still got a lot of family and friends out in that area. So, and I come back, you know, to the Rochester area quite a bit, and love my Rochester, love my Western New York.
And when you're not making documentaries, you're on New York Now. And if our listeners don't know about it, just tell us briefly about what you do.
We're the weekly wrap-up show talking about state politics. I think we're on Sundays at 6:30 on WXXI. And, you know, this is the time I guess you really want to watch the show if you're getting ready to be informed about how you're going to be voting in November. We've got a bunch of statewide races, of course, the governor's office, attorney general, state controller, and, of course, every 2 years you got your local assembly member, state senator, and congressional representative. So this is the time of year to really pay attention to what's going on so you can be informed in November.
Now, you do nice work, and I look forward to having you on again before the election. Nice chatting with you. Congratulations on 9 long days, TR's journey to the White House. Enjoyable to watch, but also you feel like you're learning things that most Americans have never seen before, and that's a credit to you, Matt. Great work.
Thanks, Evan.
Nice talking to you, Matt, and our thanks to our engineer for the hour, Dave Campo. I'm Evan Dawson. Thank you for joining us right here on Connections. We'll see you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.